This is the Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner, the podcast for anyone supporting a pregnant woman to achieve her dream birth. I'm Sally Ann Beresford, a doula, author, and antenatal teacher, and throughout these episodes, I will be sharing with you tried and tested tips that help you to ensure that any birth you attend is a positive experience. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner. I am so privileged today to have the amazing Becky Reed, who is here talking about her role as a midwife over the last few decades and what she feels about physiological birth and how important it is to have access to the right level of continuity when it comes to birth support. Hello, Becky. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Sally Ann. I'm Becky Reed. I have been a midwife for a very long time. I'm working currently, I stopped midwifery a while back, and I'm working occasionally as a doula. I run a postnatal group for mothers and babies. I'm a grandma of 12, so busy with them because I do a lot of childcare. And I'm currently writing my second book. Having written my first book, Birth in Focus, I'm now writing a book about the midwifery practice that I was part of in the early 2000s.
What made you decide to become a midwife?
So my story goes back to actually... My midwifery story really goes back to me having my kids. We did our NCT classes with Laura, and that's my daughter. And I was absolutely, completely and utterly determined to just have what I thought of as a normal birth. And it didn't really cross my mind that much else could go wrong. I suppose the reason I was really determined was because I'd trained as a nurse before I had her. And part of that training was doing a sort of component of so many weeks of obstetric nursing, being around birth. And it was horrendous. I mean, this was the early 70s. It was absolutely dreadful. It was the very beginnings of routine epidurals, the anaesthetist. I mean, I can remember it so clearly, Sally Ann, honestly, walking into work in the morning, and there would be four women in a room all lying there scared because they were all being induced. The height of social induction it was, actually. So they were all being induced, often without much questioning about why. So we did see quite a lot of babies born at the wrong time and so on. Lots of social inductions. But so, yeah, walking into the room and then about 9 o'clock, the anaesthetist would come in and say, right, hands up if you think you might like an epidural later, because it's only going to get worse. And, you know, we've got this magic tool. So the women would all be there with their hands up. So lots of epidurals. Lots of forceps, but very few cesareans. So it was all, you know, it's all sort of interesting to watch how it's gone on. But I was really questioning about induction. I just did not want to be induced. And so when I was pregnant with Laura, I didn't know anything about midwifery. Really at all, actually. I knew about nice GPs and I was very sick, so I got hold of a nice sick as in morning sickness stuff, and I got hold of a nice GP who I saw about that, and he then was my midwife, really. I mean, I wrote about this in Birth in Focus, and it's interesting to look back at what I said, but he sort of midwifed me through my pregnancy with Laura, and he taught me about continuity. He taught me about respect. He taught me about basically how to talk with women when, you know, when you're looking after them as a professional. And he was always so lovely. And then he, this was the olden days when they had kind of the GPO system, so general practitioner obstetrics. And he came to my birth. So I didn't want, did I want to have a home birth? No, I think I'd been told I probably couldn't push a baby out because my feet were too small. They measured our feet, you see. So I have got very small feet, and I was told my feet were too small. And then I also didn't go into labour when you're supposed to. So I kind of tested Charles, his name was, I kind of tested him and went to about nearly 43 weeks anyway, and by which time, you know, my blood pressure was up, and I mean, God knows now it would just not happen, but anyway, I got to the point where he said to me, you know, if you don't go into labor kind of by this weekend, it'd be really quite, maybe we should do something. And I was going, no, I really don't want that. So anyway, she was born at about 43 weeks, and he came to my birth and was brilliant, and just I mean, you know, you can't imagine it now. I mean, I know it's terrible now, but it was actually pretty terrible. So I was in Dulwich Hospital in Southeast London, lying on my back. And he came in and told me to walk, which was quite surprising, really. And then he went home because it was the late evening. And then he came back, actually, because he said he couldn't sleep. And he came back and held my leg while I was pushing her out, because, you know, we lay on our backs, didn't we? And, well, we did. And at NCT classes, I learned how to, you know, push up a hill and all those things that we know are such rubbish now. That's what kind of made me really start to think about how I could work with birth. That's what I was interested in. And because I'd gone to classes with Caroline, and she then said to me, you need to be an NCT teacher, you just need to train, I'll train you, I'll be your tutor. So I said, no, of course I can't do that, I can't do teaching, that would be ridiculous. But she persuaded me. So at some point during that time when I was having babies, I trained as an NCT teacher, and I did that for 15 years actually. So that was quite a big piece of my life. But I think doing that and just day in, day out, week in, week out, listening to women and listening to their partners as well, listening to partners, just talking about it all, I just knew that I had to kind of get in there and make change happen in a different way. So I decided to train as a midwife. But I was obviously having babies, and I had my fourth baby in 1984. And then I was thinking, well, I'll wait till he goes to school before I do anything about that. And then I had this sort of epiphany moment where I met a woman who I didn't know very well, actually, but I met her on a pavement in Catford in Southeast London, and we were just talking, and I was saying what I wanted to do, and she said, your children don't need you any less as they get older. It was such an amazing thing that I've never forgotten. You know how sometimes people say things in your life and it's something that stays with you forever? And I went home and thought, my fourth child is completely self-sufficient anyway. He doesn't really need me. I'll do my training sooner rather than later. So I did my midwifery training with four small children. Actually, it was... yeah, I mean, it felt like it was going to be a challenge, but obviously I'd done my nursing, so it wasn't going to be too long a challenge. And I just kind of called a meeting of all my friends and said, right, I want to train as a midwife. Are you all going to help? Because we did a lot of child sharing and looking after each other's kids all the time. So they all kind of signed up and said, yeah, we want you to be a midwife. That'd be great. We'll support you. So I just applied to the nearest place so that I could be around and, you know, pick the kids up from school and so on. And I did my training, which I hated. absolutely hated it. Cried most days, felt it was all wrong. I was the only student in my cohort who'd had children, and I'd got four, and I was older. The tutors never, ever mentioned it. They never mentioned the fact that I was a mother. It was quite weird. But anyway, I got through the course, and at the end of the course, one of the senior tutors, who was actually a nun, who I quite liked, she virtually went down on bended knee and said, please, 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 will you stay and help us to change things from the inside? Because I'd been talking to them about fragmentation of care and how wrong it all was. And she asked me to stay, and I said, I can't. I just can't. It will destroy me, actually, if I stay. Because in those days, you couldn't even go into community as a midwife then. You had to work in the hospital, consolidating your training, of course, and, you know, making things worse rather than better. And I couldn't bear it. And plus, I missed my kids. So we went off on a big holiday that summer. I qualified in July 89, and we had a big family holiday because I hadn't really seen them very much. And then coming back, I thought, I'll settle my little one into school, and then I'll think about what I'm going to do. And then a woman who'd been to my NCT classes rang me up in September and said she was pregnant again, and she wondered if I knew the name of an independent midwife. And I kind of laughed and said, oh, that's funny you should say that, because I might do that. That's something I might do. And she straight away said, I want you to be my midwife and you can learn on me, which was quite a nice offer, really. So she was the first person I booked as an independent midwife. And then I started working independently, and she wasn't the first. Her baby wasn't the first baby I caught, because once your name was out there, people knew. And I then had a phone call in the December from a woman saying she was booked for a home birth, but she just had a visit from the home birth midwives who rather proudly said that they had 100% transfer rate for first babies. So she rang me and said, can you be my midwife? So that her baby, who was born in the January, was the first baby I caught, and he is now 31, and he's a friend of mine. He's a drummer in a band, and he's yeah, a mate. So nice. he's very proud that he still knows his midwife. It's quite sweet. Yeah, so I worked as an independent midwife for a while, and of course I was really blessed to be in Southeast London with a group of really go-ahead radical midwives. You know, I went to ARM meetings all the time and just felt inspired by everybody, and we were all supporting each other and looking after women and not making any money at all. We were doing we were doing midwifery care in exchange for, I don't know, you know, painting the house or all sorts of things. There's lots of that going on. And that sort of was in the early 90s. And then we had a dream. You know, there was a group of us and we had a dream. And the dream was to get something that looked like independent midwifery care up and running on the NHS. And then, of course, it was 1993 and changing childbirth, and Baroness Cumberledge, Julia Cumberledge, was doing that. And they came and took evidence from us, actually, for changing childbirth. And I've got it on my shelf here, and I'm very proud to have my name in it. So, and then coming out of that was the whole idea of setting up pilot projects to do continuity of carer. And the Southeast Thames Regional Health Authority, which had a couple of really go-ahead women actually at the helm, and they decided to sort out some funding to set up a couple of pilot projects, one urban and one rural. And you know, you were invited to apply. So we put together an application, and of course, I mean, we were laughing really because we'd already had some input into changing childbirth. So we got the funding for the urban project, and that was the South East London Midwifery Group Practice, which never ever got itself a catchy name, so we called it SELMGUP, but actually it never got a good name. And we won, can't remember quite how much. It was one of those big checks that you can walk with, you know, that they give you. But it was a lot of money, but it wasn't, I think it was £30,000. So it was a lot of money, but it obviously wasn't enough to pay midwives' salaries. So then we had to find a way of getting some money for this dream. And so we started pitching it to the local health authorities, and we made appointments to visit the appropriate people. And eventually, I think it was Lambeth, Southwark and Lewisham, eventually they found a pot of money to give midwifery care to women who otherwise might not have accessed it. So at the beginning of that project, we had a whole list of priorities of women to care for. We found a home in a place called the Orkney Centre in Deptford. Yeah, we set ourselves up in 1994, but they didn't start out with offering us enough funding to pay us. So we had a big meeting around Nikki Leap's kitchen table, and we all committed ourselves to working for half pay for a year to get the project up and running, because we kind of knew that this was the time, this was the moment. It was amazing, actually. I mean, we really were able to do what we wanted to do. So to be honest, I think we were way ahead of our time. We had a shop front with a social worker who did support and actually termination counselling and referrals to us if women wanted to come to have their midwifery care with us. And she, I mean, basically we were bypassing the GPs, which was actually quite revolutionary. But yeah, it worked. It worked for us and it worked for the women we looked after. And we were able to get going with all our big ideas. So we did total continuity of carer. We had contracts with four local hospitals, because this is London, so there were some few hospitals, and also obviously the option of home birth. And we had a very high rate of home birth at that time. So that, I mean, that was about 60% home birth in that time, for a short while anyway. And we set up our antenatal groups and our postnatal group and found a way of working that really worked for us. And that funding lasted for 3 years, nearly 3 years. And towards the end of the 3 years, we had a visit from a man who I remember we thought he was a schoolboy, but actually he was the funding manager for the health authority. And he came to deliver us a gloomy message, which was that Lambeth, Southwark and Lewisham had got a £19 million overspend. So they were having to cut back on their projects, and one of the projects they were cutting back on was ours. Which was devastating, because we were really taking off, and you know, the women were coming and they were all wanting what their friend had, and you know, it became a real sort of community focus, and we were really getting the results for the women and the families that we were hoping for, and we were all pretty happy with what we were doing. Anyway, we were in Deptford. We were based in Guy's area, and so we went straight to the head of midwifery at Guy's and said, please, we've got this brilliant project, can you continue to fund us, because we were losing the funding from the health authority. And she said no, But one of the other hospitals that we were linked to was King's, which is a little bit further away, but not too far. And Cathy Warwick was the head of midwifery there. Cathy Warwick, who subsequently went to the RCM. Anyway, we went to see her and told her she knew because she was on our steering committee, actually. So we went to see her and said, right, Cathy, we would really like to come and be a midwifery group practice within King's. And we want to be a bit different. We want to be self-managed and self-employed, and we want to do total continuity of carer, and we want this, 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 and this. And she actually said, I like this idea, I like this plan, let's see what we can do. And eventually we got a subcontract to work as a midwifery group practice at King's. So this is spring 1997. We changed our name to the Albany, and we moved to Peckham, in also southeast London, which was an area of high social deprivation, which is precisely exactly what we were hoping to do, because what we were obviously trying to do with our practice was to prove a model of care. And we had a very interesting conversation with Cathy Warwick about numbers. So we went with 206 women a year for the practice, I think. So we needed roughly that amount of women to be referred to us by GPs. We were allocated this GP practice that was based on the North Peckham housing estate. Now, this is 1997, so we're talking, 24 years ago? The North Peckham housing estate was famous at the time for being the worst estate in Europe. That's what it was known as. So we thought, great, all right then, from the point of view of doing what we wanted to do. But we had obviously ideas of women coming to us for groups and so on, and they didn't want to come. Of course they didn't. We stuck it for a while, and then quite quickly we spotted some building work in Peckham, and I remember going to ask the builders what they were doing, and they said, we're building a community centre, I think they said, or something, or I think it was going to be called a health and leisure centre. So we went, bing, that would be great, let's see if we can get a room there. So we watched it being built, and we went to see Cathy Warwick and said, look, what would really work best for our model of midwifery care is to be based not in a GP practice, but in somewhere that's not medical at all. That's somewhere women want to come to, that's got different facilities. Can we have the funding to have a room at least in this brand new health and leisure centre, which was going to be called the Peckham Pulse? And she said yes, and we were the first people to get a room there, actually. And there was a bit of a fight to get a room that wasn't, to get a room that even had a window, actually, but we did. And so that's where we were based until we were closed down in 2009. Do you have any questions?
I would love to hear more about what continuity of care means.
That's easy. So you live in Peckham, you are on the list of one of these GPs in North Peckham, and you think you might be pregnant, so you go to the GP. And the arrangement was that the GP would literally then just sign you over. So he would just say, right, we've got a practice who are looking after, doing the midwifery care for our women. Here's a note. So pop along to the Peckham Pulse and they'll tell you all about it. So what happened then was that the woman would say hello to our practice manager, because we had a practice manager as well, which was also very important part of the model. And she would just say, you know, when do you think your baby's due? And then we would have already arranged our holidays for a long time ahead. And then she would allocate you to one of these midwives and say that midwife was me. And I would find your name and a set of notes in my pigeonhole. And then I would contact you. And then basically we would then start a relationship. My favourite sort of name for it really is relational continuity of care. So I like a continuity of carer. I like the fact that we can include that you have a relationship with your midwife and your midwife has a relationship with you. But anyway, so I would see where you're up to, what was going on, had you got an appointment for a scan, did you understand what that was all about, would you like to talk about it, when could we get together, and I would arrange a booking visit with you at your home. And that was part of really quite important for us to do a booking visit at home so that we kind of could get to know you in your own environment and possibly meet anybody else who was around you, so your mum or your partner or your any other kids if you had them. And then we would allow a good amount of time for a booking visit, and at that visit we would explain to you what continuity of care meant, which really was you will have two named midwives. You will have a primary midwife, who's me, and a second midwife, who's possibly Mary. And you will get to know both of us during your pregnancy. And then when you have your baby, we will be there when you have your baby for you. And then we will look after you for 28 days afterwards. And we would say, you know, the chances of us being there are really, really high. We're going to be around. We're not going to be away. So the only thing that would stop that really would be if we broke our legs, or really unusually, if there was another woman actually having a baby at the same time. But I think in my long career as a midwife, that's only happened to me less than a handful of times. And I think you could kind of see, you could actually see women relaxing at that point. It was like, I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to think about anything. Plus, all the questions that women get asked at a hospital booking visit, a lot of them we didn't have to ask. We didn't have to say, what are your plans or anything, because you didn't have to have plans. We were going to be alongside you so we could see how you see how your pregnancy progressed, see how your ideas progress, see what you felt like later on, really. And then we would arrange based on a kind of sort of template of antenatal care that the hospital was doing loosely, but we would obviously individualize that and say to you, when would you like to see me next, when would you like your next appointment. And we would then, having done a booking visit at home, we then would ask you to come to the Pulse for your antenatal visit. You had your own clinic, so maybe I can't remember now, but maybe I had, say, Tuesday mornings, Wednesday afternoons or something. So just give you a time. And so you would see me and later on meet Mary. And then providing everything went relatively straightforwardly, you would only see us. If you needed or wanted referral to any other professional, so an obstetrician or somebody else possibly, if you had other issues, then we would arrange that. But say your pregnancy is straightforward, then you would see just us. And then at around 36 weeks, we would do what was called a birth talk, which would be both of us, both your midwives and you and whoever you fancied being at your birth. So again, if it's your mum or your sister or your partner or possibly your children, then they would come to, and we would come to your house, and we would allow really realistically a couple of hours for that, and we'd do a really good session on getting ready for your birth. And that's where, you know, you were talking earlier on about obviously support for partners, but really this is where this came in a lot, because it was really about talking about what use is a midwife in labour, and what use is somebody you love in labour, and what, you know, at what point do you need or want these different things? And although the 2 hour thing, a lot of people have said to me over the years, that's a bit of a long time for an appointment. But my goodness, you know, you made that up for the woman in labour, knowing that she didn't need a midwife.
Definitely. All the work goes in the antenatal period, doesn't it? And makes a huge difference then to the length of the birth. So you know that you are going to be there for a lot less. What did you say to birth partners? What was the conversation like?
When you say birth partners, obviously a lot of the women we looked after had their mum as their birth partner or their sister. We had a very high Black African caseload, and a lot of the men maybe didn't want to be involved. So lots of the women we looked after had either their mum or a mixture of people as birth partners. So it was, you know, there wasn't this idea of just one birth partner. It was whoever was going to be around. And we talked through about labour, and you know this, of course, but we used photographs a lot. So to talk about things like, you know, what might happen, how labour might start, all the rest of it, and positions and what can support you, and how normal it is. And I think really, honestly, an expectation of normality all the time. So that nobody thought that, I mean, obviously we would, I can remember obviously lots and lots using the phrase everyday miracle, because for you it's a miracle, but actually babies are being born all the time and most of them come out fine and most of the labours are straightforward. So basically approaching it like that, and really hopefully just taking the fear out of it, or not letting the fear creep in, because when you look at what's going on in birth at the moment, it seems to me that there is just so much fear. So keeping it straightforward, them explaining what is the job of a midwife and how midwives can do very little at the beginning of labour, and thinking of things that would help to get you through, and talking about when to call and how to call, all of that, but also sort of saying that, I think just constantly stressing really that a woman who goes into labour at term with hopefully, well, in this case, say one baby in a good position, starts labour at home, and then labour continues, those women almost never have problems. So when you look at the problems, the problematic outcomes, they don't usually come from births that have started spontaneously and continued spontaneously. They just don't. Obviously, occasionally things happen, but it's rare. It's really rare. So thinking about that and understanding that birth, if it starts well, usually continues well, and understanding that, and also talking to them about the fact that certainly for first babies, labour is often quite boring. It's quite long. There's long pauses. There's nothing's going to happen in a hurry. It's not like you see on the telly, you know, all of that kind of thing. Just really trying to make it real for people, but also at the same time, making sure they know that you're there for them. So you're there. You know, let us know what's happening. We will keep in touch. We'll be there. If you want us, call us. We'll come. So never saying we won't be there, but also saying you can do this and you don't need me to certainly hold your hand in the beginning part. And probably your labour will progress much better if you don't have people coming in and, you know, just being an extra person in the room, really.
Yeah. There was always that, the words normal or natural, and now it's physiological, which fits it much better, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it's a good word. I like it. And you're right. I mean, normal has become a dirty word in midwifery, of course. We know that. And that's, I think, for me and my generation, that's quite sad, really, because obviously we talked a lot about normal birth and we had definitions of what we sort of thought was normal birth. And we collected our statistics a lot based on or with reference to what we thought of as normal birth. But physiological fits it exactly. It means the same thing. It means the same thing. And we want to include in all of that the things that are often not included, like the physiological birth of the placenta and, you know, the beginnings of your time with your newborn, all of that. So, yeah, I think that birth talk was a real preparation for women, and they looked forward to having their birth talk. And of course, you know, we were doing these antenatal groups and people would talk about things like that all the time. This was all about building up to people feeling prepared, feeling safe, feeling supported, feeling cared for, and then just not thinking about it. You know, I don't really mean not thinking about it, but not worrying about it. And, you know, to be honest, a lot of the women who we looked after in Peckham had much bigger things to worry about than their birth, and I suspect that also fed into how they at the end of it had quite a lot of physiological births, because they weren't screwed up about it, really.
They weren't over analyzing.
That's it, absolutely. And you know, I've often said that, you know, my favourite people to look after are teenagers and women who I've looked after before, because those are the women who, I mean, teenagers just do not worry about giving birth. So they just get on with it. And then women you've looked after before, they kind of know they know what they're doing. Yeah, I suppose it's all about finding that magic, isn't it? It's finding that little bit of magic that takes away the fear, that stops indeed the overanalyzing, the over testing, the over interpretation, all of the stuff that we see now in women's pregnancies and births that is so upsetting and is so unnecessary. Yeah. So just to finish the continuity, because that was going back to your question, so we would do the birth talk and then be on call for your birth, and you would call us when you wanted to. Obviously we would say to you that, I mean, we had quite strict rules about calling us, actually, you know, as in don't call us in the night if you don't need us type of thing. Yeah. But by then you would have a relationship with the pregnant person. So you would, you know, that person would be thinking, oh, I'm not going to wake Becky up now because I might need her tomorrow night. So we would have explained all that. It's your first baby and you're thinking something's starting. You at 4 a.m. you probably are going to be having your baby the following night, you know? Yeah. That sort of thing. So a lot of mutual respect, and then we would come to you when you wanted to see us, and unless somebody was actually in hospital already, which would have been highly unlikely, so they'd have to be ill basically, or one of the very few women who was being induced, everybody would be starting their labour at home. So we would have said to you all the way through your pregnancy, you can have your baby wherever you like. And lots of the women choose to have their babies at home. If you think you'll feel safer or more comfortable in hospital, that's fine too. Obviously, we'll be with you, but we will come and see you at home when you go into labour with a full set of equipment, and you do not need to decide where you're going to have your baby until then. So that means, you know, that question is not on their kind of tick box antenatal list.
That's the best gift you can give to anybody, because if you think about the amount of people that go into hospital too early and end up with interventions due to the fact that they have arrived in the unit too early, you've removed all of that. You've given them the peace and the freedom to just allow the labour to develop. When you arrive, that's when you can say, well, okay, you know, now's a good time to go in if that's what you want to do. And you take away that responsibility, which is fantastic.
And of course, here's a surprise, women don't want to move.
No.
If they are labouring well at home and their midwife turns up, why on earth would you, as a mammal, want to go somewhere that you don't know? I mean, it's cliches, isn't it? But why would you want to get in a car, go somewhere you don't know, meet people you don't know, with an environment that you haven't chosen? Why would you do that? I mean, you know, you'd do that if you were afraid, and you'd do that if you didn't trust. But if you trust your care provider and you feel comfortable and you've worked out, because you're doing it, that actually you have got enough space at home, or you have got the right people with you, or the things that other people worry about all the time, then, you know, that I think I know that that's why we had such a high home birth rate at the Albany, because we were working like that with women, and they were having more straightforward pregnancies because they felt safe. And I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced that the reason we didn't have lots of preterm births is because women kept their babies in longer because they felt safe. And that's been shown by research. And they just were in a completely different headspace, I think. And then just got on and had babies. And then we would, obviously, wherever you had your baby, we would stay with you afterwards until we were certain that you and the baby were fine and the baby had had a good breastfeed. And then we would be on call for you. So you know that you've got a midwife who you know who can come and see you, or you can go see them for the next month. And then after that, we ran postnatal groups. So they would come to postnatal group for, you know, the following year probably, and get lots of support there. So a lot of it was about community and community support as well. So the whole picture was much bigger, expanding into public health, you know, so that we had much higher breastfeeding rates and far fewer interventions, so, you know, less infections and all the rest of it.
I think continuity of carer continues to be the thing that everyone is told they should be providing. And yet it just seems to get further and further and further away. And I know the last, you know, 18 months with COVID, it's become harder and harder for women to access the same person, you know, at all. And very rarely have ever met their own named midwife because of staffing issues or illness, etc. And you can see why it is the gold standard, can't you? Because when you talk about it, Becky, you can hear just how much of a difference it makes to everyone in that family, and how that family will start their lives together in a very, very positive way. And if you've got children already, you know, the children will get to know the midwife and the partner and the mother and the sister or whomever is involved in that pregnancy and that birth. And it's just wonderful to hear you talk about what continuity of care means. I just wish it was accessible to more people. And I know as a doula, obviously, and I know you work as a doula now, we're able to provide that, not from a medical perspective, but definitely that familiar face, that person who really does know their wishes inside and out, which is very, very important from, like you say, from a letting go of the responsibility of what's on your mind in labour. The minute that person walks through the door, you know that they know what you want, and that's amazing. So yeah, thank you so much for explaining it all. I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your book, Birth in Focus, because you mentioned it earlier, and it's such a beautiful book. What gave you the idea for that book?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Okay, so for quite a long time I had been writing articles for the Practicing Midwife, with an original format, which because it goes back to the fact that we were taking photographs. So we used photographs a lot in our practice. We used them for explaining things antenatally. We used them in groups. We used them at the birth talk. And we would always say to women, and I always had a camera on me. This is pre iPhones and things. I always had a camera on me, and I would say to women, if you would like photos of your birth, then I will take them for you, or the second midwife, usually that was her job, we'll take the photos for you. They will be for you, absolutely not for us. And lots of women said they would like them, and then quite a lot of women said, would you like copies to use, because I'm very proud of my birth photos, so would you like to use them to show someone else? So that's how it went. And I am sitting at my desk now, and by my feet I have got two huge boxes of pre-digital photos. So these are photos that I've collected over the years, and some of them actually were used in the book, not many but some. So I had the photos, and I had this idea of using photos to explain things, because I don't know if you remember the thing that Tricia Anderson said, but Tricia said about some of us are more visual and people learn visually rather than through reading text. So I was writing these articles using interesting births that I'd been at, and just writing around the subject and using birth photos. And then after the practice was closed in 2009, my son and his wife, who were living in Brixton in Southeast London, had their first baby at home on Christmas Eve, little Isabella. And in the January, I was round there with them, having my fun with my little granddaughter. And Jacob said to me, that's my son, he said to me, what are you going to do now, Mum? And I said, well, I think what I might like to do is, I'm thinking about writing a book, as in putting together some birth stories and making a book, which, because I don't think there's anything like that on the market, and I think it would be really valuable. And he surprised me then by saying to me, ah, okay, well, you need to meet Maria. And this was quite interesting, because my son works for the Foreign Office, knows nothing about publishing or anything like that. So I thought, what's he on about? But anyway, it turned out that he and his wife, Nikki, had been to NCT classes with a woman called Maria Pinter, who turned out to be one half of Pinter and Martin Publishers. And Maria was doing her NCT classes behind the offices in their house, behind the offices. So they'd had to troop through the Pinter and Martin offices to their NCT class. And he noticed that they were publishing midwifery type books. So I talked to Maria, and the upshot of it all was that I went and had lunch with them. And I went for lunch, and I took a portfolio of all my published articles, because I thought, well, they might like to have a look and see how I write. But anyway, they'd obviously talked about it. And I don't know if they were kicking each other under the table or what, but at the end of it, they offered me an advance and said, we'd like you to write this book. Interestingly, they said to me at the time, the book that we would really like to publish is a book about the Albany. And I said, no, I can't do that. It's too close, too emotional, too raw. I'll do this one and we'll see how we get on. And that's interesting to talk about now, because the book about the Albany is coming out next year. And it's in its kind of final first draft stage at the moment, and I'm writing that with Nadine Edwards, who used to be vice chair of AIMS. So anyway, that's what's going on in my head at the moment. But anyway, so Birth in Focus was just such a lovely thing to do. It was so lovely, because I had to bring so many things together with it. You know, it was a lovely idea, but obviously what it entailed was quite a lot of going back to my Albany past. So I had to have sets of photos of an interesting birth. I had to still be in touch with the people because I had to obviously talk to them about it. I had to find them. Then they had to agree to, I would say, fairly graphic photos of their birth, because that was my idea, that it would be real photos of real births, nothing kind of done with Vaseline or anything. And so they had to agree to that going in a book, which may well, you know, travel around the world. And so what I did was I basically got myself a spreadsheet. I call it a spreadsheet. It was actually pieces of paper, of course. And I wrote down all the things that I wanted to include in the book. I've got it somewhere. It's quite interesting to see how I did it. But I wanted to include as many different issues, ideas as I could. So from first babies to grand mal tips, from home births to hospital births, from straightforward births to complicated births, and you know, other interesting things like meconium and cord around the neck, and you know, pulsating cords, all the things that I talked about that I, you know, that I knew we'd been talking about all the time we were running the Albany, and I had to kind of try and get that all condensed into about 15 stories. Anyway, I did all that, and then I contacted the people. And what was absolutely fantastic was that nobody said no in the beginning. And then one person, which is really sad actually, but one person changed her mind, and she is a woman who I'd looked after when she was 15. And she'd had the most beautiful water birth at home, and the photos were great, and you know, all of that. And then she said yes, but I think her mum actually suggested that she might not think it was a good idea. Oh. So she didn't go in the book, but all the other people said yes and were really pleased to be in there. And I was just so, I was bowled over actually by their commitment. And but I guess it comes back to I know it goes back to the whole continuity thing. You know, they knew me, they trusted me.
Yeah.
They trusted that I wasn't going to mess with their story. And also I started a new thing, which was to get them to write their story as well, as you know. So the stories in the book have the story from the midwife's point of view and the story from the mother's point of view. And then the first person I went to see to talk about it was actually Natalie, who had been working as a midwife in the practice, and she had a really interesting birth with an egg donation baby and preterm birth where she tried to stay at home, and then we transferred in. And you know, it was just interesting, with lovely pictures of course as well. So I went to see her to talk about it, and her husband Brian joined us for lunch, and he said, can I write my story? So I said, lovely idea, let's do that. So there are quite a few partners' stories in the book, and then a couple of siblings who had been old enough to really remember and were there when the baby was born, and they've written some nice pieces as well. I love them. I just love them. Yeah, every time I look at it, it makes me feel happy.
It's a beautiful book, and I highly recommend it to anyone listening. It really is a very special book, and like you say, sort of one of its kind, isn't it? It's not nothing else like it.
Well, what was interesting was, one of the things I did before I wrote it was I did a bit of research as to what was available for example, student midwives, to really see what birth looked like. And, you know, I've got copies here in my study of things like May's midwifery, Miles Midwifery, the textbooks for midwives that they are supposed to learn from. And I couldn't find one single photograph of birth. Not one. And I just was a little bit, I mean, I suppose I kind of knew, but I was still quite shocked when I tried to find it and I couldn't find it. Which made me really feel even more sure that it was right to get this book out there with pictures of how babies are born.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're in the 21st century and there are women having babies who don't know what it's like, what's going on, you know, and for partners as well, and for children. And it's amazing how many people have sent me photos of their kids reading the book and really being fascinated by seeing where babies come from. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it has sort of found a little niche, and it seems to be very quite popular. One of the things I do is I have the books at my house, so if any, you can obviously buy them on Amazon and you can buy them through the publisher, but I also am quite happy to do signed copies, so if anybody wants to contact me, that's fine. So my phone number is 07843 282951, and just WhatsApp me is probably the best way, or send a message, and if you get in touch, then I will get back to you and we can make it happen.
Thank you. I always like to finish with the same question, which is, what top tips can you give to any birth partner supporting a woman through the birth of her baby?
Right. Okay. Interesting. So top tips for a birth partner would be, make sure that you, before birth, make sure you know what she wants. During birth, be prepared for her to change her mind. Always take your cues from her. If she says no, don't. If she says do, do. Watch the midwife. If you feel doubtful or scared, because this is something I always used to say to the partners and everybody at the birth talk, actually, you know, just, I promise you, I'll be honest with you all the way through. And if you're worried, just look at my face. And enjoy. Enjoy. This is an amazing thing that you are being privileged to be part of and bear witness to. You will see your partner in a way that you have not seen her before, and be prepared to be absolutely mind blown by the whole experience. It'll be bigger and huger and more amazing than you can possibly imagine. A little baby coming into the world.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Becky. So I'd really like to thank you for your time today. It's been amazing, and you've given such great information and shared your story, and it's been a really enjoyable time. So thank you.
You're more than welcome, Sally-Ann. Bye.
Bye. Take care. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner with me, Sally-Ann Beresford. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review and don't forget to hit subscribe. If you are on Instagram, you will find me at The Ultimate Birth Partner. Please feel free to follow me for more ideas on supporting women through the birth of a baby. If you would like to purchase a copy of the book that accompanies this podcast, then head over to Amazon and type in Labour of Love, The Ultimate Guide to Being a Birth Partner. If you would like to work with me on a one-to-one basis, visit my website www.birthability.co.uk or email me hello@birthability.co.uk.